It was in our 14th year that he started hitting me. In the 13 years prior, I had told myself that he was a decent man because he didn't hit me. The truth is that he did everything but hit me, and the only thing that stopped him from hitting me is that he never needed to do it to keep me in line. I now understand that abusive men use their abuse to control women, not because they lose control of their emotions. So, what happened in the 14th year? I started demanding household equity. I bought all this shit about how he's just a nice guy and just needs me to explain it better to him. So I did. And he understood what I wanted, didn't want to give it to me, and started hitting me. It's all deliberate. Everything they are doing is deliberate. All of it. Hi, I'm Zahn Vilines, a writer and feminist activist, and this is the Liberating Motherhood podcast. I am here today with the legendary feminist philosopher, writer, Substack author, hero, inspiration, wonderful human, Kate Mann. Hi, Kate.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for that lovely introduction right back at you.
Yeah, Kate is awesome. If you are not familiar with her work, I hope you will get familiar with it. I think you are all gonna love this interview. So let me tell you a little bit about Kate before we get started. Kate Mann is an associate professor at the Sage School of Philosophy at Cornell University. She specializes in moral, social, and feminist philosophy and has written three books: Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny, entitled How Male Privilege Hurts Women, and Unshrinking, How to Face Fat Phobia, a National Book Award finalist in nonfiction. In addition to academic work, she regularly writes opinion pieces and essays for a wider audience, including in outlets such as The New York Times, The Cut, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, The Nation, and Time. She writes a Substack newsletter, More to Hate, exploring misogyny, fat phobia, and their intersection. If you are not subscribed to Kate's Substack, I highly, highly recommend subscribing. She writes amazing work, but there's also really interesting, compelling discussions going on in the comments. You can learn so much and gain so much inspiration from reading her. So I really hope you will. I will put all of her information in the show notes, and hopefully she'll tell us a little bit more about the work she's doing and why it's important and all of that. So we're going to get started. Kate, your work, more than any other philosopher who immediately comes to mind, provides what is, in my opinion, the most helpful blueprint for understanding both why individual men do what they do and also how patriarchy functions as a system through these men. How did this happen? How did you gain so much insight? And can you tell me, like, how you see your own work in the larger feminist movement?
Yeah, well, thank you so much. That's so kind. And I really began to think about misogyny as a social force in a serious way in 2014 after the Isla Vista killings. So they happened over Memorial Day weekend, which is coming up. So it'll be an anniversary of those events where Elliot Rodger was a young 22-year-old man who had posted these YouTube videos, these screeds about the women who weren't sleeping with him, who weren't giving him sex, love, affection, and adoration. And he eventually decided to slaughter a whole sorority house full of women. So he drove to the Alpha Phi sorority house at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Loaded weapons in hand. He knocked on the door, was denied entry, and then ended up shooting three young women who were walking outside around the corner, killing two, wounding one of them. He also killed four young men that day in a kind of drive-by shooting spree. And before that, he stabbed to death his three roommates. So it was this horrific massacre. And what was so striking about it to me as a feminist philosopher was the way that so many people in the media denied that this was misogyny immediately and reflexively, when it was so obvious to me, and I think virtually every feminist, that this was an act of profound entitlement and that it really exemplified something in the culture where men feel entitled to certain goods from women and women are deemed obligated to supply these goods. And so that kind of framework really emerged from thinking about this case, but it was something where thinking about this case got me into thinking about so many other phenomena, from domestic violence to sexual assault to family annihilators to the kind of aggression directed toward political leaders who are female. I found that this way of thinking about what women are held to owe and what men are deemed entitled to, it generalized to more phenomena than even I had expected.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I remember most about that story is how it was constantly depicted as a crazy person and as mental illness, when to me, it was just, well, this is not someone behaving crazily. This is someone behaving consistently with the values that our culture taught him.
Yeah, and I used as the subtitle of my first book, The Logic of Misogyny, because I do think that this is not a set of random, unpredictable, wild acts of people who are just completely out of touch with reality. What they have is a set of corrupt moral values, which say that they should have this role in policing and enforcing patriarchal norms and expectations. Chief among those is the idea that women should give certain things like sex and love. And so it's not some kind of random lone wolf act. This is a very deliberate act, to use a word that your letter writer used in opening. This was a very deliberate act of saying, when women don't give me certain things, I will lash out violently. And that makes sense because women need to be taught a lesson, according to these values that say women are bad women and bad people for not being more giving, loving, attentive, and admiring. And that is incel logic, but it's also the logic of misogyny more broadly.
Yeah, I just got this letter for my advice column that I'm going to publish in about a month of a woman who, it's kind of the typical story. She doesn't have household equity and she wants more fairness, so she confronts her husband. And it's not really socially acceptable to say, well, you're just less than me, so you have to do it. So he comes up with like the usual excuses, and then she keeps pushing and he attacks her. And then her question to me was, what can I do to get him to understand? And, my response was basically, oh, he understands just fine. Like, that's why he attacked you, is he's escalating to the next thing that he can do to keep you in line. This is not, it's not a failure of understanding. And I just like wish that we could get past that finally.
I think that is exactly right. I have been railing for a long time against the idea that misogyny is viewing women as subhuman or less than human or somehow mindless objects. A lot of forms of misogyny are completely contingent on ascribing to women agency and sexuality and the ability to do all sorts of distinctively human things, but then insisting upon controlling those sorts of capacities and mental attributes and traits. And so, this idea that somehow it's all about ignorance or just not having thought it through completely, yeah, I think unfortunately that's wishful thinking. They understand very well, they just don't like what they're confronted with, which is the full humanity of women and the fact that we have autonomy and our own desires, our own needs, our own interests, and equal rights.
Okay, so I on that point, I have sort of a philosophical question for you that you might not have an answer for, but you kind of have an answer for everything. So I think that you are the sage advice giver that we need, and maybe you'll have insight into this.
This is a lot of pressure. Let's see.
But no pressure. You're perfect, but no pressure. Okay, so there's this thing that I write about a lot where basically, if we viewed women as equally valuable to men, All of the things that we dismiss as small concerns, like her doing more household labor than him, her getting less sleep than him, her not getting support after she gives birth, her not getting care when she's ill, all of these things that get dismissed as like, oh, those are just petty issues, it would quickly become clear that these are not petty issues because this is basically the theft and destruction of another person's life. So if we thought that life mattered as much, if we thought that time mattered as much, we would not see these as small things. We wouldn't see these things as, well, you have to communicate better. You have to make him understand. So my question is regarding women who have internalized this idea that you can't ask men to sacrifice anything for you. And also, the experts, the therapists, the coaches, whoever people consult about these problems, who just don't seem to see these issues as serious. Like, what is that? To me, it feels like it has to be seeing women as less than human, but you've made me think differently about that issue, so maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, so that is a really important point, which I think is often somewhat underappreciated in kind of post-enlightenment thinking. But some human beings who are recognized as human beings are allotted into service roles in a social hierarchy. So I think there is this kind of myth that really is of a piece with Enlightenment thinking, and which I found very powerful for a long time too, that as soon as we see that someone is kind of the same as us in a particular way, say in being a human being, we will really take them just as seriously and value them just as much as a white, adult, non-disabled, rich, cis white man. And I think that the history of how human beings treat each other really belies that point. One way to see it is that a lot of the worst things people do to each other are not just things which are incredibly brutal. They are things which are distinctively human to human kinds of cruelty. So they are premised on the idea that this is a human being who should know better, who has the capacities to internalize rules and to follow norms, for example, patriarchal norms and expectations, and who, unlike a non-human animal who usually can't be expected to know or do better, it makes sense to punish a human being, to resent a human being, to lash out and try and correct a human being's behavior because they do have these capacities that allow them to learn and grow and repent. And that's what I think we see oftentimes when it comes to misogyny that women face, which is the idea that they are human, all too human sinners, rather than being seen as somehow incapable of learning or knowing better. But again, it's a sense that they're, as I put it, sometimes they're not human beings who can just be in the world. They're human givers who have this particular social task of giving and loving and serving men.
Yeah, okay, that's really thoughtful and helpful. It's almost sort of like women earn their humanity through service.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that in a way, our humanity is something that is not always embraced by people whose humanity has long been unquestioned. Like the other way to think about it is there's this idea that is very prevalent that as soon as you recognize someone as a human being, you're like, oh, good, they're in the circle, they're in the club. But why would that be true? Sometimes people's humanity is actually very inconvenient if you were allotting them into a service role, thinking of them as someone who is entitled to do and feel the full range of human activities and feelings. There is something about that that can be very confronting to people who have viewed certain people as perhaps not less than human, but as particular kinds of humans with particular roles and with, again, this kind of service value.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we can all generate like a dozen examples of that happening, whether we're talking about war or slavery or even like the way we treat children and the role we put them in. So, yeah, I mean, this idea of like disciplining people into the role they belong to is kind of what your first book, Down Girl, is about. You know, you talk a lot about misogyny as this like disciplinary force, a way that men get what they want from women and from the larger world. I think we obviously see that in the opening vignette, but I think we also see that like in daily life all the time. I talk to women all the time who tell me about men who do things like weaponize bad moods to prevent their partners from asking for equitable distribution of household labor. Or whose partners selectively verbally abuse them in the postpartum period, like so that they could get meals or house cleaning, which just shows like how little they value these women, that this is what they're willing to do. So talk to me about this idea of like misogyny as a disciplinary force and how it works and tell me more.
The definition that I give of misogyny is pushing back against the idea that misogyny is hatred for any and every woman. And it comes down to this idea that misogyny is something that is a disciplinary tool that often actually rewards quote unquote good female behavior while punishing people for being bad with respect to patriarchal norms and expectations. So, when you put that idea together with the idea that misogyny is something women face rather than something that men feel, you get to the following definition, which I offer of misogyny, which is that misogyny is the hostility and hatred that girls and women face, which has this particular social role of policing and enforcing patriarchal norms and expectations. So oftentimes, women will be targeted quite selectively for being a particular type of woman who's deemed bad by patriarchal lights, or they will be targeted for doing things that are deemed bad in particular social contexts. So it will be rewarding her when she's being a, self-sacrificing, giving, loving, devoted wife and mother, but punishing her whenever she asks for more or better or more equitable treatment. So I think that's kind of at the heart of misogyny, that it involves punishing quote unquote bad women and oftentimes actually valorizing and lionizing women who are toeing the line and who know their place within patriarchy.
Yeah. So I feel like I've seen this recently in my own family, actually. None of the people who I'm about to talk about listen to my podcast, so I can talk about them openly. So I had this very feminist grandmother who was like not at all, you know, the trad wife. She, you know, bucked social norms. She always worked, you know, she pushed back on everything. She taught me to be an activist. And she's been dead for like 20 years. But, you know, everybody always talks about like how much she would love, you know, my anti-male hate group, how thrilled she would be. And, but then Mother's Day came this year, and multiple members of my family posted all this stuff about her as like a military spouse, as a wife, like not even mentioning her as a mother, because like she was a really good mother, and motherhood is like skilled labor, so it's kind of like that's almost too good for her, but just like lionizing her as this perfect gender normative like wifely person. You know, no mention that she had a job, no mention that like she wrote poetry and was super educated and, you know, like raised all these feminist grandchildren who are out in the world terrorizing men. It was so weird, and I started like getting really upset about it, and I then like thought of you, and I was like, they're slotting her into the role of like a good woman, and they earnestly mean this as a compliment to her. They're like rounding her up to, in their mind, like better than what she was.
You know, that's so insidious, and it really gets at this way that praise can be oppressive. So this is a concept that's recently been defended at book length by Jules Holroyd, who's a wonderful feminist philosopher. And it's the idea that it's not just punishment that can be coercive and controlling, though of course it is. It's also that when we pick particular versions of a person or particular behaviors that are not their full suite of behaviors and hold those up for particular praise, that can actually have a role in saying, no, this is the only part of you that we value. The rest of it is a liability or worse. And that falsifying of people's memories, especially when they're gone, I'm sorry for your loss, by the way, she sounds amazing. But that way of falsifying the memory of someone can be a way of saying not just about her, but to future generations, well, this is how you get remembered fondly. You do these things, the wife part, the mother part, the self-sacrificing part, the military spouse part. The fact that you were highly educated and autonomous and educated and feminist, all of that is unmentionable.
Yeah, well, and I think it's become even easier to do now that we have social media, so we can really like reify and reinforce those messages. It's just like really striking, especially if you now, I mean, most men don't bother to celebrate their spouses as mothers at all. But you know, the ones who do, like if you look on Facebook, they're just kind of like sickening, the messages. Like it's really just like celebrating women as like uteruses.
And a bundle of services that are feminine coded. Like she gives so much, she loves so much. And look, all of these are good things. I'm not anti-care or anti-love, of course. But you don't see fathers getting held up in the same way for the same things on Father's Day. You don't see the sense that they've somehow redeemed themselves for their careers by being capable of care work. Partly because oftentimes they're not doing nearly as much care work as they ought to be, but also because even when they are, it's not necessarily what we hold up as the be all end all. So I think I was just thinking, Zon, when you were talking, I think a really good project for someone doing sort of discourse analysis would be to take eulogies of men versus women and see
Yes.
what they get celebrated for.
It's interesting because I was thinking about that when I was reading these tributes to my grandmother, because she married someone who was like her, who was, you know, very intelligent and had like an activist spirit and all of that. And, you know, I remember the eulogy for my grandfather was all about like his military service and his cool jobs and like all the things that he did. And I remember like people saying about my grandmother, oh, she was a perfect Christ-like model of love. And it's like, well, not if you were a racist being threatened with her beat stick, she wasn't. Like,
Good for her. Yeah, no, exactly.
so just somebody should do that. Somebody more patient than me.
Same.
But yeah, totally. Okay, so I want to switch gears a little bit because on your Substack, you've been talking a lot more about fascism. And I love it that you're doing this because I feel like you're like my feminist coach for survival, my feminist fascism life coach.
Oh no, I'm barely surviving.
Well, you know, you're what we've got. So we're gonna run with it. But the thing that I've started to notice is how fascism functions as this disciplinary tool too. And not everyone is equally victimized under fascism. And the whole goal is to get people to fall in line. And it seems to track kind of perfectly with your theory of misogyny. Do you think so?
Yeah, I really do. I don't think that we can really understand and see the full force of the ills of fascism without understanding misogyny as a model. Because this idea of domination and having people forced into line such that it really becomes in their own interests to fall into a line, that is something that people practice within the family. Within the nuclear family in particular. And so heteropatriarchy provides this model that then gets applied at the level of the nation state to our government, to our leadership, and to the way that citizens are constructed under fascism, I think is very much owing to this model of how we can control people within the family via a patriarchal head of a household.
Okay, so this reminds me of something that is happening in my city, Atlanta. And I don't know. Well, I'll ask you. Are you familiar with any of the like Cop City stuff? Has that made its way to you?
No.
Okay, so I'll give you a brief overview because I think if you
Please.
haven't heard about it, probably a lot of listeners have not. So Atlanta is a very progressive city. It's majority black. We almost always have black leaders. It's just this little like bastion of progressivism in the Deep South, and it's kind of always been that way. This was, the birthplace of the civil rights movement. Just tons and tons of activism. So it is no coincidence to me that a few years ago, the Atlanta Police Foundation decided that they were going to build a center to practice urban warfare in the middle of Atlanta. And so they annexed this historically black neighborhood that was essentially a forest, and they've built this thing that they're calling Cop City. And they're practicing fighting citizens and killing civilians and shutting down protests there. So there's been a huge protest movement trying to stop it. I mean, our entire city has been like taken over by this protest, and it culminated in the first killing ever of an environmental activist 2 years ago on the site where they were going to build Cop City. So, like, what does this have to do with anything? Well, to me, what's been most interesting is that we have a progressive mayor, we have a progressive city council, even like our police chiefs are supposed to be like pretty progressive. And they have all fallen in line with building this Cop City thing. And what has happened is that opposing this just obviously awful, offensive thing has become increasingly stigmatized, even in progressive movements. And so organizations that were, sponsoring the opposition, that were providing legal aid to the opposition, are now like not getting donors. They're being, put on like no donation lists. And among people who consider themselves activists, among people who have, risked things for leftist causes. And so I feel like we've really seen the falling in line. And as a result of the falling in line, this Cop City Center that seemingly no one in the city wants has finally opened just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh my gosh, that's so awful. I mean, gosh, just the opposite of what we need. And it really reminds me of this point that I keep coming back to at the moment, which is that fascist actions are usually straight out of the domestic violence playbook.
Yes.
Like, there's just a way in which they draw from these particular tactics of like coercive control. So you have the intimidation, the threats, the way that even the equipment and the uniforms threat up this, they set up this enormously threatening facade that can be used to control people because it's scary to oppose that kind of force, fairly obviously. There's also the element of it that's reversing victim and offender. So almost inevitably, at the moment, the people who are the offenders in the kind of civil rights violations that we see being perpetrated by cops who are committing things like state executions. They are, in fact, the offenders, but they're presented in a way as victims who need to defend themselves and who are so vulnerable that they need this heavy-duty military equipment in order to survive, despite the fact that in the vast majority of circumstances, they're the aggressors. They're the ones who are escalating. They're the ones who are out of control. And yeah, you also have this aspect of it too that I keep thinking about, which is the financial abuse and corruption. Like, a really good way to keep people in line is to make sure you control the purse strings and that you can prevent them from doing certain things unless they do toe the line, unless they do know their place.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I've been thinking a lot lately about how money enables people to escape fascism, sometimes without leaving, but oftentimes by leaving. And so these threats to people's jobs, inflation, all of this really, really threatens people's lives in a way that I think is unfamiliar to a lot of people, maybe.
And very familiar to a lot of women. So I see maybe a lack of tapping into that resource of we have people who both theorize this, but also people who have experienced that kind of coercive control and financial abuse who could illuminate in a way the conditions of living under fascism because they have lived under fascist rule at home.
Oh yeah, this is such an amazing point. I hope you're going to write more about this because that's totally what's happening. And even with like the victim blaming, we see how women get derided in family court as crazy and unhinged. It's always that they're crazy. And we do the same thing with protesters. You know, they just lost control and they're a threat and they're a terrorist and all that kind of nonsense.
That's a really good connection too. That's really important.
All right, so speaking of domestic violence, I want to talk about Entitled a little bit. This is your second book where you talk about how men's entitlement affects women, which I love because you're centering women instead of, you know, centering men. I see so often in my own work how this entitlement manifests, but also how women internalize it as like a male right. So, for example, you know, most women will say that they want equity and that men and women should have equal opportunities and equal treatment and all of that. But they feel guilty about asking men to give anything up. And there's this idea that women asking men to give anything up is unfair. So it's like, sure, you can have household equity, but he can't be sleep deprived. He can't miss out on his hobbies. He can't experience discomfort. If he's sick, he needs to rest, which are things we definitely don't believe about women. And I think that this has become like so normalized that it's not even really visible to us. It's just the way things are, which makes it even harder to disrupt because if you push on it, it's like you're pushing on the fabric of the cosmos. So I guess my question is like, one, how do we make that phenomenon as entitlement more visible? And what did you learn about how entitlement functions when you were writing your book?
That's beautifully put, Zahn. I think there is this way of thinking about it that I've found very liberating in my own life, where you really have to see it as like two competing moral systems. So in the patriarchal system, where one question that a lot of readers naturally had after my first book was, like, what is patriarchy today? I think in a way that question is less salient now because we've seen just such revanchism that people are less skeptical. But at the time when I published my first book in 2017, like just the week the Me Too movement was popularized, after having, of course, been led by Tarana Burke for over a decade, people were wondering, well, what are these norms and expectations in this superficially more egalitarian, some people would say post-feminist moment, where, I mean, no surprises, I don't think we're anything like a post-feminist or egalitarian society, unfortunately, yet. But the answer that I came up with and that really animated my second book was the idea that these norms and expectations are taking this form of men feeling entitled to certain goods from women, especially women who they're in relationship with. So he feels entitled both in the kind of dating world of an Elliot Rodger, but also within patriarchal households after partnership or marriage, and especially after children. He feels entitled to sex, yes, but just as insidiously, to love and service and labor and material labor, emotional labor, domestic labor, reproductive labor. He feels entitled to children from her, namely his female partner, in ways that are not reciprocal. So instead of her being deemed entitled to love and affection and admiration in kind, she's deemed obligated to provide the goods that he's entitled to receive. And this sets up a really powerful moral framework where it makes sense of the fact that when a woman asks for what is actually morally required, namely equity, fairness within a household, she's pushing against moral ideas that are very entrenched, which say that not only is she not entitled to equal labor from her male partner, typically a husband, she is actually doing him wrong by insisting upon equity, according to this old framework that kind of sticks around. We have this moral hangover from patriarchy that is both something some people still explicitly believe in, but it's also something that many people implicitly believe in, even when they think of themselves as more progressive. The idea that women would feel really guilty and, in a way, mean or unfair, and subsequently ashamed for asking for what they are genuinely due to get in moral reality. I think that makes sense in light of the fact that there is this old moral framework that says she's not entitled to those things, she's obligated to provide her husband with them.
Yeah, that's such a good point. One of the things that I have seen that just makes me like banana pants in my interactions with people is my husband and I like really have an equitable relationship, not like equitable except for this thing, which I think is what like a lot of people have. And so like I write about it in my work because I want people to know that this is not innate, this is a choice.
Totally.
And one of the pieces of feedback I get from readers and like acquaintances is, well, but then why is he with you? Like, why does this feel like a good deal to him? It's like, well, I'm great. Like, I'm awesome.
Yes. I mean,
Yeah,
yes.
but I think like it goes, and these are like good people who don't see themselves as sexist and all of that, and who like me and think I'm great. But it just goes to show that like we really have great difficulty seeing women as anything other than appliances, basically.
Yeah, bundles of convenient services. And yeah, I think distinctively human services, like a lot of the services are loving and giving, nurturing in ways that only human beings can do. It's also interesting that comment because it really underestimates your husband. So I am often accused of being overly pessimistic about all of this, but I tell people, in a way, a lot of what I'm saying springs from a place of hope and trust that men can do better. And I know it's possible because it's actual. Like, my own husband too is a genuinely co-equal parent, sometimes more so when I'm in particularly busy work periods because I'm the main breadwinner. And he is a just really deeply serious feminist. And it sounds like your husband is too, in the sense that there are lots of men who don't want to take advantage of social permissions that say you could get away with an immoral system where you're exploiting someone. And some men, and this is a real credit to them, will opt out of that and say, no, I want to live fairly and justly. And what's in it for me is partly that you're great and I'm great, but it's also that I think there are really, people in the world who don't want to take advantage of oppressive and exploitative systems, and movements like feminist, social progressive movements and anti-racist movements rely on there being people who don't want to take advantage of unjust privilege. They want to help dismantle it.
Absolutely. Well, and like, so I'm really skeptical of this whole like feminism is for men too, feminism benefits men
Same.
too, because like, yes, it does, but men should be feminists even if it doesn't benefit them. But I do think like it's really important to help people understand that participating in a system like this is inherently degrading, and it degrades the oppressors and the participants just as much as it degrades the victims. And also, the thing that I see with men constantly is that misogyny erodes their ability to think clearly and critically. It like turns them into not fully human. They're just like replicating patriarchy. And like, who wants that? Who really wants to live that way? Like, don't you want to live a full life and, die without regrets, like having known that you've had like meaningful relationships? I mean, I don't know, call me crazy, but that seems like a better way to be.
Yeah, well, certainly the leadership of this country is not an advertisement for the clarity of thinking engendered by imbibing patriarchal norms. I think, yeah, we really need to separate out two things here. There's this idea that feminism helps men because there are various self-interested reasons for men to do the right thing. And that can be true, but it can also be false. Like, there are things that men will genuinely have to give up when it comes to a more egalitarian household or state. And yes, there are also benefits that are real in their own interests, like having real meaningful relationships with their children, which was much less possible under patriarchal lore. But the really important thing is that it's the moral reasons that trump all of those self-interested reasons, just as there are moral reasons for people who are white like us to divest from racism, there are moral reasons that are overriding for men to divest from patriarchy. And so, whether or not it's in their individual self-interest in any given case, morally speaking, they ought to be feminists. And that's enough. It's actually enough.
Yeah, I love that. That is enough. So my husband and I recorded a podcast, I think 2 nights ago, where he was drinking a beer and just like freely talking about things. And like one of the things that he mentioned was this very small interaction we had where he was taking the toddler to her little pre-K class and he had like forgotten her baby potty. And so like we had to like negotiate how we were going to get the baby potty to her. And what he pointed out is that, like, every step of the way, there were like all of these excuses that he could use to make me do the work. And any of them by themselves would seem like genuine excuses. It wouldn't seem like misogyny, like, oh, I have a deposition and I can't be late, or I have this thing and I have to be ready, or I already did most of the driving. And like, all of those seem perfectly reasonable. And then, like, if you just continue making all of those perfectly reasonable excuses, it just adds up to like a lifetime of the woman doing everything. So I think men need to consider what reasonable sounding things they argue that are not either reasonable or fair.
I think that is exactly right. And I think that as women, we often need to ask ourselves too, like, is this merely tolerable as a domestic arrangement, or is this genuinely fair and equitable? And not to victim blame, but just to say in a liberating spirit, like, if you're not getting as much sleep as your male partner, you're entitled to that. You're entitled to more sleep. And if you're not getting as much leisure time, you are entitled to that. And entitlement to me is not a dirty word. Like, I wanted to make that clear in my second book. People are genuinely entitled to lots of things. We're entitled to respect and to be treated non-exploitatively. And, we're entitled to good health care and to be cared for at home in a reciprocal and mutually supportive way by loved ones. It's just that women often get really overburdened with obligation, particularly when it comes to caregiving. And we get really short shrift when it comes to what we're genuinely entitled to, especially from male partners who, yeah, I loved the way that you put this before, and it's also so important and something you've done to highlight so beautifully in your work, the idea that women are just not getting cared for when they're ill or when they've just had a child, when they have just had major abdominal surgery in many cases, or severe pelvic trauma from birth, we're still oftentimes not getting that basic care and love and support that should be part of every healthy relationship in a reciprocal way over time.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So we're talking about all the reasons that men should be feminists, that it would be better if they were feminists, that it makes sense for them to be feminists. And yet, most of them are not. And even the ones who are often extremely disappointing and don't behave as feminists. So I want to talk a little bit about Bernard Williams, because I
Ooh.
think that an internalist position kind of helps explain a little bit of this. So let me try to explain, and then you can correct me, chastise me, and expand on what I've had to say. So you advocate for this internalist position, which is basically that a person does not have sufficient reason to endorse a moral claim if they cannot internally justify that moral claim. So, like, no specific piece of evidence or fact about the world necessarily motivates action independent of what a person thinks or wants. You wrote about this early in your career. I think we see this a lot in patriarchy, and I think we see this idea in your work. So say something about that, Kate.
Well, I think you put it beautifully, Zahn. I think there is this powerful idea that we do find in Bernard Williams, which is called internalism about reasons. And it's basically the idea that you don't have a reason to do something as an agent unless, in some sense, that speaks to something you care about or desire or are motivated by. And one of his examples of this, which I now suspect actually got me into thinking about internalism and being very sympathetic to this position and ultimately defending it, is the case of the callous husband. So this is in his 1995 paper, Internalism About Reasons and the Obscurity of Blame. So it's a follow-up to his original piece, Internal and External Reasons. And he has this husband who we're trying to motivate to be nicer to his wife, even though he treats her quite brutally. And Williams has us imagine ourselves into the position of someone trying to reason with this husband and saying, "But don't you understand? It's your wife. You have reasons to be nicer to your wife." And the callous husband responds, "Don't you understand? I don't care. I really don't care." And what Williams says about this case is that we can say various things about this husband, that he's nasty, brutal, sexist, other disadvantageous things. But the one thing that we can't say anymore is that he has a reason to be nicer. And the thought, I think, or so I've argued, is that rational conversation has met with its limits there. He doesn't have a reason because he's not open to rational persuasion on this point, because there's nothing in his heart, as it were, in his, as Williams puts it, motivational set that you can kind of appeal to get him into this way of seeing things are right. So it's not that he's somehow okay, he's a bad guy, but we have really hit up against something that matters, which is he genuinely doesn't care about being nicer to his wife in ways that mean rational persuasion and reasonable conversation is off the table. And so we have to do something else. We have to, for example, try to get his wife to leave this guy rather than trying to persuade him to be nicer. It's time for her to sever relations with him, maybe for us to sever relations with him. At least until he does care about what he ought to care about.
I love it that a man writing in 1995 seemed to appreciate what's happening with this particular dynamic more than a lot of the like feminist therapists and influencers, self-proclaimed experts seem to now, 30 years later. Like, can we just be done with this argument? Can we just accept that he doesn't care, that it's not that he doesn't understand or that he need something explained to him? Like, can that one be done? Like, can you speak on behalf of philosophy and declare that debate over, please?
I think that's so right. I mean, I was really struck when I read Jancy Dunn's book, How Not to Hate Your Husband
Oh my
After
God.
Kids,
Oh my God.
which like I have a whole chapter in Entitled about it because it made me so sad.
Know.
And yeah, the basic premise of the book is her husband does less than 5% of the child rearing and domestic labor, despite the fact that they both have very similar full-time careers as freelance writers. So it's radically unfair. And she's trying not to hate him instead of like divorcing his ass and moving on. And I mean, I don't blame her. It's understandable, but I also feel like so frustrated throughout this book because the project is how not to hate him instead of how to free yourself from this completely unfeasible situation. And they eventually go to a marriage therapist who says, "Oh, here's the problem. He's entitled." "No, I'm on your side, Jancy," the wife who wrote the book. He says, like, this isn't a situation where there's, wrong on both sides. He is irredeemably entitled. And yes, like you could do this or that differently, but basically he needs to change or else. And I don't think he ever does, and I don't think that ever materializes into a situation that does seem feasible. Like the book ends with, she's still doing almost all the labor and she's still crying. And she still needs the box of tissues that the therapist handed her in the office because it's unsustainable. And she is rightly furious and sad about the fact that her husband simply does not care about being nicer to his wife.
Yeah, it's so sad, and there are so many books like this. I remember, like, years ago, I would read, a feminist book where, like, she mentioned in passing her husband not participating in household labor and parenting, and I would get, like, so frustrated because it was like, but why? Like, you writing as a feminist don't even see women as, like, fully human, that you're accepting this, and it took me a long time to understand how incredibly victim blaming that is, because what's really happening is that there are so many structural barriers to women leaving that I think women have to play a lot of tricks on themselves to just accept these horrible circumstances. But I just wish we could all, like, collectively say, fuck all of those dudes. Let's stop talking about why they're doing it and start talking about how we build a system where women can safely leave.
That is so right. I mean, I've been really radicalized on this by Liz Lenz's book. My friend Liz wrote the book, This American Ex-Wife, which is
Yeah.
fantastic and is really just making the argument that historically and currently, marriage does not serve women when it is heterosexual marriage, at least. And that, rather than all of these band-aids and stopgap solutions, if you're in a relationship that is deeply inequitable and where you're not able to flourish and grow, then it's not to say you ne can necessarily leave because of these deep sources of, structural barriers to doing so. But ideally, that would be what would happen. And we need to work towards making it the case that that's both destigmatized and also that it's financially viable.
So Liz Lenz's book has been particularly gratifying to me because I read, I think it was her last book, there might have been one in between the two, Belabored.
So good.
And I remember getting so upset about the marriage dynamics she talked about in that book that I was actually having nightmares about her and her husband.
Oh, wow.
And I had to stop reading it. And I was just like, please. Please, can we leave this man behind? And so when this book came out and the man had been left behind, I was just triumphant. I was so happy because it was like the last book set up the plot for this one, even though it's, another human being's life rather than a plot.
But it's so good. I had a similar feeling when, I mean, even though I knew the ending, which in a way is announced by the title, This American Ex-Wife, when she describes leaving for 24 hours for, I think it's a work commitment,
Yeah.
and she leaves her two kids with her husband, and then she comes home and the trash is just on the floor. Like he hasn't taken out the trash. And so, like, garbage juice is leaking all over the floor where it leaves a stain. I just like threw the book across the room because I'm like, what grown adult doesn't take out the fucking trash? I
Right?
mean, it's just like, having these amazing, brilliant, incredible women in relationships where just the most basic reciprocity and self-care and care for children and households is somehow meant to be beyond full-grown adults because they happen to have a particular gender. Like, that is wild to me. That is absolutely wild.
Well, and it becomes so clear how this is a deliberate act of like undermining her life's work and her potential. And
A
this is what
hundred
I
percent.
see all the time is these brilliant women who are at the top of their career. I've talked to two women recently who two different women who are math professors who have been like heavily recruited by universities to like move across the country or across the globe. And these universities are just like throwing money at them because they're so good at their work. And then the men at home are just like digging at them constantly. And I'm like, these women have done so much with so little support. Like, what more would they do if they were either single or with a partner who actually supported them? Like, we're just like, we're really not even getting to see everything that women are capable of because we're just like, collectively pulling on their feet constantly.
Yeah, that's totally right. And it's tragic. I mean, just think about the loss of talent and just all of the women who could be doing those amazing things or doing more amazing things or simply having more fun, but for this kind of patriarchal situation, which again, you're totally right, is not inevitable. I'm pretty optimistic that lots of people could do better. And even if the husband, the callous husband of William's imagination, doesn't care, I think a lot more boys could be raised to care and to really take this seriously earlier on, in which case, I think they could be motivated to not want to exploit women they're in relationship with.
Yeah, I'm seeing it already. So my oldest is in second grade, and I'm starting to see like a little bit of the entitlement with boys, especially with like crushes. And my daughter is just like amazing at setting firm boundaries. It's just a remarkable thing to see. And like I'm seeing these boys learn. It's, you know,
That's
imagine
awesome.
that. Imagine like having boundaries around your behavior. Teaching you, and they're like, oh, well, I didn't realize that was hurting you. Like, okay, let's do it differently. And it's like they're 7 and 8, and they can do it. Okay, so we're just about done. We didn't even get to talk about your latest book on shrinking. So I'm gonna put it in the show notes, but if you would like to say a little bit about that book, please do.
Oh, yeah, sure. So the premise of it is basically that you can't understand misogyny without also understanding fat phobia. Because, look, I think fat phobia affects really almost all of us in some ways, but it affects people who are fat and female, particularly insidiously. And that's because, think about it like this: if patriarchy was deliberately designing a tool to control us and make us small, meek, quiet, hungry, spending enormous amounts of time, energy, money, and bandwidth on this, in fact, futile task of shrinking our bodies. Because for most people, we can lose weight temporarily, but the weight comes back nearly inexorably, according to most studies. Yeah, it would be a perfect tool for social control. So, in order to think seriously about patriarchy and misogyny, I think we also need to think about fatness and think about ways in which women are told to be thin in a way that isn't just shaming or makes us feel bad about ourselves. It also means that we lose so much life and we get so controlled by this goal that, yeah, we're not able to be truly liberated, I think, until we see our bodies as valid, regardless of size and shape.
Yeah, it's a great book. It's very research intense. If you find yourself bristling at the idea of fat phobia, that's a sign that you really need to read the book because I think those are the folks who really need this book the most are the people who either think that they're bad because they haven't lost weight or think that other people are bad because they haven't lost weight.
Totally.
Thank you so much. This has been amazing. You are amazing. I'm so glad to talk to you.
Thank you so much. This has just been such a fun and, in all the best ways, confronting conversation. So I'm just glad to be confronting these truths with you and your audience.
Well, thank you. To everyone else, if you like the podcast, I hope you will consider sharing, heart reacting, commenting, engaging in any way. It really does help make it more visible so that more people can find it. Also, if you would consider leaving a positive review on your favorite podcast platform, makes me easier to find, which means that I can do more episodes. Thank you so much, as always, for listening, and I will be back in 2 weeks.